Our next case this morning is number 054718, the United States against Lappe. Mr. Judge.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mary Judge with the Federal Defender on behalf of Mr. Tony Lappe. The lower court had absolutely no statutory authority to send FBI agents to the Westshire Nursing Home in Cicero, Illinois, to arrest and to lock up Tony Lappe for purposes of a dangerousness hearing 2 years after the Attorney General properly placed him into the care of the state of Illinois. A district court in the Northern District of Illinois does not have the jurisdiction or the authority to oversee the actions of the Attorney General or to oversee court proceedings conducted in a federal district court in Minnesota. A federal district court does not have statutory authority to micromanage an individual state's handling of its mentally ill persons, even if the persons are mentally ill and dangerous. The Attorney General, the Minnesota court, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota properly complied with the mandates of 4241 and 4246. Yet this district court's order is contrary to the statute, contrary to the actions of the district court in Minnesota, contrary to the Attorney General, despite the fact that Congress clearly has given authority over incompetent defendants to the Attorney General. Likewise, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Illinois asserts a position in conflict with its counterpart, the U.S. Attorney in Minnesota, as well as the actions of the Attorney General. Mr. Lappe's been caught in the middle of this conflict, and his liberty interest has been wrongfully deprived of his liberty since November 15, 2005. The statutory provisions in this case, 18 U.S.C. 4241, and 18 U.S.C. 4246, those that govern the methods for handling and dealing offenders with a mental disease or defect, are not ambiguous. They are very precise and very clear. The competency statute mandates that the court shall commit the defendant to the custody of the Attorney General if it finds by a preponderance that the individual is incompetent. If, after a period of hospitalization, it's determined that the individual is not competent and not likely to be restored in a reasonable amount of time, the statute then subjects the offender to the dangerousness provision, Section 4246.
What is the legal status of the defendant in that context? It's my understanding that the 4241 commitment expires after the time limits are exhausted and the determination is made that the defendant is not likely to be restored to competence. And then there is the possibility of a 4246 commitment proceeding, which was initiated here but then withdrawn. So I'm not real clear on Mr. Lappe's legal status after that occurred. I mean, the 4241 commitment had expired. The 4246 commitment proceeding that was initiated, which is what the statute contemplates in this situation, was withdrawn. So does he revert back into the custody and control of the criminal court?
Well, the criminal court and the criminal case is not directly impacted by the 4246 statute. The criminal court cannot try someone who's incompetent. It's been determined that this individual is incompetent and not likely to be restored, so the next step places him into the 4246 dangerousness statute.
And the criminal charges are supposed to be dismissed, right?
The statute does not require the dismissal of the of the indictment.
And but the law
in this
does.
Case, in this case, the defendant filed a motion for dismissal, and that was denied. The government filed a motion for dismissal, and that has not been ruled upon. The defendant cannot appeal and be successful based on current case law, a denial of his motion to dismiss the indictment. At this point in time in our case, Mr. Lappy was not arrested, so we did not appeal that issue. Once, to go back to your question about 4241 and 4246, once the 4241 is terminated because there's a decision about that, he goes into 4246 and there has to be a certification filed, which is done in cases where the director of the facility of the hospital where he is staying certifies that they think he's dangerous and certifies that there is no state facility available to him. This was done in our case. This was done in Minnesota. And once the state found, once the Minnesota facility found a suitable state placement for Mr. Lappy, they then withdrew the certification because they could obviously no longer certify that those two conditions exist.
Once that happens, then the state facility takes him in. Is that, in your opinion, the end of the federal court or the federal jurisdiction?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what seems to be the problem here.
That's right,
Judge. They
didn't
end it. Now, there's some contention that because the indictment or wherever whatever status wasn't dismissed, that it somehow got back in here. And our earlier order from this court doesn't seem to help anything any. I'm not sure where that puts us. But it does seem like we're we've gone in two directions, and somehow or other we got to back up. And I'm not quite sure how we can do that.
Your Honor, what I think the problem is that the competency statute doesn't deal with what do we do with the underlying criminal case. And it actually probably shouldn't. I mean,
It should just sit there. It's over.
It's over. The judge has an option of dismissing the case or leaving it pending. But he clearly cannot try someone who is not competent and not restorable.
Well, is there authority to leave the case pending?
There's no authority to leave it pending. There's no authority that requires that it be dismissed. Now, in the Seventh Circuit, there's case law that says once the government moves for dismissal and the judge denies the dismissal motion, that the judge is acting beyond his powers of authority. It's the prosecutor's purview, and that case should be reversed. But in this case, although the government filed a motion for dismissal, the judge never granted the motion, the government did not pursue it, and the government obviously is not appealing.
What intervened to cause that motion never to get ruled on? I mean, it seems to me that the case law is pretty clear that there's further basis to keep the criminal case pending.
Motions pending, and I, as the defendant's lawyer, was advocating much stronger for my motion to be dismissed, and it's clear he was not going to dismiss the motion. Perhaps the government, and they, of course, can better address the issue, can let the court know why it wasn't further pursued. I think because it was clear the judge wasn't going to dismiss the indictment. But as I said, procedurally, from my perspective, I had no remedy at that point, because I can't ask this court to dismiss, to reverse the lower court's denial of my dismissal, even though that is, the appropriate remedy in this case. So now we're in a position where 2 years later, my client's liberty interests are at stake. He is in custody at Kankakee County Jail. What medications he's receiving there is unclear.
So he's in criminal custody. He's in jail.
He's in criminal custody.
He hasn't been admitted to bail.
There's really no, the government and the defense agreed, there's no basis to subject him to a bail statute at this point. There's really no basis for this judge to go out and have this client arrested at this point in time. He's acting contrary to the statute.
The last order, our December 8th, 2005 order, that went back, and then the court was going to have a hearing on the dangerousness, right? And then that was appealed. That's what we've got up here, right?
That's right, Judge.
Well, see, maybe our last order should have done something else. Maybe talk about what we're talking about now.
The Seventh Circuit remanded the court to address the issue and to follow the statute. And we're filing this appeal because the judge can't follow the statute, cannot hold a dangerousness hearing.
He should have dismissed it then or done something.
Right. Of course, it would have been preferred if the remand said and dismissed the case. That would have been my... that was not done, and you know, and the judge read the ruling as requiring a dangerousness hearing, and I attempted to clarify with the court that that is not what the ruling was. That the court was suggesting that the court follow the statute and was preserving the issue of whether a hearing was even appropriate. But he misread the remand and said, "No, they're requiring that I have a dangerousness hearing."
What do we actually have before us? As I see things. We've got a criminal case that has not yet been dismissed. We don't really have a 4246 civil commitment proceeding before us because that was appropriately venued in Minnesota and has been terminated. And we don't have a 4241 civil commitment on competency because that has expired.
What we have is the wrongful arrest of an individual who has a federal criminal case pending but can never be tried or convicted for that offense, and the only thing left to do is dismiss the case.
And that's what you're asking for?
Yes.
Okay.
Anything further? Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Matthew Getter for the United States. As an initial matter, Your Honors, this case is improperly brought at this point. The appellant is seeking to use the collateral order doctrine to attempt to get this issue in front of the Seventh Circuit. We disagree with whether or not that applies in this case. As we've stated in our briefs, we don't believe that the second factor of the collateral order doctrine applies in that the issue before this court cannot be taken apart from the merits of the case below. And that's because the case below has been torn down to only one issue, that being the same issue that's before this court, whether or not the defendant poses a danger to others and to the property of others. Because the issue before this court is precisely the same and the only issue remaining before the district court, we don't believe that this is properly before the Seventh Circuit.
Well, of course, the underlying criminal action is still pending in the district court.
That's true, Your Honor. It is. But since there's been a determination under 4241D that the defendant is incompetent and not restorable, the government cannot prosecute the defendant. So while the indictment remains, we cannot prosecute the defendant as it stands now. So all that's left
is... So why haven't you pursued your dismissal motion?
Judge, we did, when we filed the motion to dismiss, as was clear from the pleadings, there really were no procedural options for us at that point. Judge Darrah had denied our motion for a second competency hearing, and then he had denied our motion to reconsider that denial. At that point, not being able to prosecute, we filed the motion to dismiss. It was when we got up in front of the district court on the motion to dismiss that the judge seemed to reconsider, without a motion before him, seemed to reconsider his prior denial of our motion for a new competency exam and said, this is the sort of thing that I think should be subject to a 4246 dangerousness hearing. Given the combination of Judge Darrah's apparent reconsideration of his prior denial of our motions to continue the competency issues, as well as what we perceive to be gaps in the statutory framework of 4241 and 4246, we did not pursue the motion to dismiss.
Why did the judge think that 4246 was properly before him?
I think, I can't speak to what was in the judge's mind.
Let me rephrase that in the way that you're about to answer it.
Okay. I'll do it that way then, Your Honor. I think that the reason why a 4246 hearing is appropriate before the district court is, first of all, I think the most important thing is that jurisdiction still vests in the district court for the criminal matter. The fact that the petition in Minnesota was withdrawn divests the district court in Minnesota of jurisdiction over any dangerousness issues, but does not divest the district court in Chicago. from dealing with competency issues, whether 4241 or 4246. The court here in Chicago still has jurisdiction over the criminal case, and as a result of its jurisdiction of the case, has the authority to conduct further competency proceedings.
Well, that may be the case, but that's not how this proceeding was characterized by the lower court. Apparently it was characterized, and everybody went along with it, except the defendant didn't, but you went along with it, the judge's characterization of this as a 4246, which is not about competency. It's about
dangerousness,
and it's about federal civil commitment post-competency, post-4241, when the defendant is found incapable of being restored to competence.
Well,
and there was no certification from any mental health institution director that is necessary to initiate a 4246 proceeding. As I understand it, there was one in Minnesota that was withdrawn, that proceeding was terminated, and so we're in this sort of no man's land right now.
If I could, Judge, let me respectfully disagree with one thing you said. When you said that there is no there's no certificate that would be available to initiate the 4246 hearing. Well, it's true that the certificate was withdrawn in Minnesota. The certificate that's filed under 4246 really has two purposes. The first purpose is a notice provision to give the defendant due process, notice of his rights to a hearing under 4246, and that was in the Baker case that they cited from the Sixth Circuit. The second reason for the certification is to provide the jurisdiction for the district court in the district where the defendant is located to conduct these hearings. Were it not for for the certificate, the district court in Minnesota would have zero jurisdiction or authority to hold such a hearing. Given that those two purposes, I think it's fair to argue that since their certificate was filed, it put the defendant as well as the district court in Chicago and the parties on notice of the fact that the defendant posed a reasonable danger. All that the withdrawal of the certificate did is divest the court in Minnesota of the authority to hear this. But the court in Chicago, given the notice that a defendant in its pending criminal case poses a danger to others, that the district court in Chicago can still hold a 4246 hearing. The defendant is now in the Chicago area. He's in this district. There is no medical...
In state custody, though, right?
Well, no, he's in federal custody.
Well, though. I know he is now. But when all of this came up again in Chicago, he was in state custody because he had been transferred from the Minnesota hospital where the 4241 observation proceedings were conducted, which had expired. And then he was transferred to the Elgin Hospital and was then in state civil custody, right?
Actually, that's not exactly true. At the time that this issue came, at the time the parties learned, or at least we learned, that the defendant was no longer in state custody, he was not in state custody. He had been released from Elgin, allowed to leave about a month after he was voluntarily admitted to Elgin, and was at an outpatient facility somewhere, I think, in Arlington Heights. So he was, I don't believe he was technically in state custody. The state had abdicated its, what we believe is its responsibility to treat this defendant. The state had decided that, essentially, had decided that the defendant didn't need any further treatment, which really raises the issue of whether or not the initial state placement was suitable. Under 4246, there are two things that are required. One is a danger to the community, and the other is suitable state placement. It appeared to Judge Dara, it appeared to the government, that the placement at Elgin was not suitable. And certainly, that's one of the two factors that the district court in Minnesota could have considered had there been a hearing up there, and the suitability. And it's certainly something that we believe that the district court here can consider, whether or not it was suitable.
But that's not a determination that the district court or the government are, well, certainly the district court can't do it sua sponte, and the government doesn't have the authority to do it either. It's got to come from the medical professionals where the defendant is being cared for, that's how the statute reads.
Well, if that were the case, Your Honor, then the hypothetical where a defendant is, let's say in this case, the certificate had been withdrawn, the defendant were put on a bus and sent to Elgin. On the way to Elgin, the state government had a budget cut and closed the Elgin facility. And there was no placement for the defendant. He's already out of the federal custody. He's on his way to Elgin. Elgin shuts down.
Well, is that actually how these civil commitments are terminated and defendants are turned over to state custody? I mean, I would assume that there was some sort of an order that transferred the defendant's custody from the Minnesota hospital to the Elgin facility and facilitated that change of custody and vested custody and control in the state. That's how the statute reads, and maybe if that didn't occur here, you can tell me, but that's what's supposed to happen under the statute, seems to me.
The only thing I saw was a letter from a social worker at the Rochester facility in Minnesota saying, to summarize, here's Mr. Lappy, he has a federal case, he's being sent to you for treatment.
How did he get there?
I don't know. Physically, I don't know how he was transported. I know he ended up there. It happened without the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago knowing about it. The certificate was withdrawn. We didn't know. He was sent to Elgin. We didn't know. He was released from Elgin. We didn't know. We only found out from defense counsel afterwards.
Yeah, but
you folks ever talk to the U.S. attorneys in Minnesota?
They're nice folks up there, Judge.
You
but
talk
we don't.
To them?
At the time?
That's basically the problem here, isn't it? I mean, if somebody dropped the ball, it was dropped by the United States government's executive branch in the state of Minnesota.
That's true.
And you're trying to mop it up now and make the best of a bad situation because your confreres dropped the ball.
Well, that's one way to look at it, Judge. What we think, though, what it boils...
If you want a federal court of appeals to help you out.
What we believe is that there's still jurisdiction, still authority in the district court in Chicago to hold a 4246 hearing. And that's why we ask, Your Honor, that you remand back to the district court for its holding hearings consistent with 4246 and 4247. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gatter. How much time? Well, again, Ms. Judge, I'll give you a moment, 1 minute, if you have something you'd like to say.
I would just like to add that the Minnesota court and the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office followed the statute. They placed him in the care of the state. It doesn't require civil commitment. The statute, 4247I, itemizes what the Attorney General's responsibilities are, and it has shall, you know, blah, 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 in certain sections, and then it has may request civil commitment. It's not required. May place him in state custody, may turn them over to the state. And the idea behind this is that states are in a much better position to deal with the mentally ill. If they get a person into their custody, however they walk in, whether they voluntarily walk in, whether they're placed there from previous federal custody or not, they have professional responsibilities. They deal with the mentally ill within their own state. If they're dangerous, there's precautions that they take.
Is there some document that reflects the termination of the Minnesota proceeding after the withdrawal of the certificate and also reflects the defendant's custodial transfer to state care and custody?
There's a document, there's letters, there's correspondence that we have, and I believe they're attached in the appendix in the briefings, letters that state we are sending this person, but you know, anything official, anything more than that, I don't have.
Well, I've seen those. There isn't anything more official saying Mr. Lappy is hereby transferred to the care and custody of the state of Illinois pursuant to 4246 and whatever the applicable civil statutes in Illinois would be for civil voluntary commitment purposes. As I understand it, this was a voluntary commitment.
Right. This was a voluntary commitment. So just as anybody off the street in Chicago could voluntarily place themselves in a mental institution, that's what happened here, only he was driven probably by the marshals from Minnesota to Chicago and was voluntarily placed there.
You haven't seen any kind of formal document that reflects that?
I have not seen anything the court has not seen.
The facility in Elgin, Ms. Judge, what part of the Illinois government runs that thing?
I honestly don't have an answer to that, Judge. I'm happy to look it up for you. It's the Elgin Mental Health Center.
Run by the state government?
I believe so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.